please the court.
My name is Lieutenant Scott Stobner, and I represent Lance Corporal Roberson in today's case.
Leave of the court, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
That's granted.
The critical issue at trial in this case was whether Lance Corporal Roberson acted under duress when he forged his roommate's checks. And indeed, the military judge instructed the members on the defense of duress. And in those instructions, he informed them that the government bore the burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt that that defense did not, in fact, exist. At trial, the military judge excluded critical evidence that demonstrated Lance Corporal Roberson's fear of violating Maxim.
One question. You said the issue is on forgery. What is the duration of this offense? Is this a one-day event or multiple-day events?
Your Honor, it was charged with two different specifications, which were 7 days apart.
And the specification stated that the act occurred on one particular day?
Yes, sir, that is correct. At trial, the military judge excluded critical evidence, as I stated, that demonstrated Lance Corporal Roberson's fear of Dominic Madsen. And that fear came about as a result of statements related to him. And additionally, the military judge excluded evidence that demonstrated Dominic Madsen's intent to carry out that threat. As a result of the military judge's rulings, the members, when determining whether Lance Corporal Roberson acted under duress, did not get to consider that critical testimony, which came from a neutral and disinterested defense witness. I intend to discuss briefly the excluded evidence based by the trial defense counsel's theory of admissibility, and then I will discuss the prejudice to Lance Corporal Roberson's case that resulted from these exclusions. Turning first to the testimony of the witness, Donnie Matthews.
Can you first lay out, please, if you would, your theory of duress, and in particular focus on the concept of immediacy?
Yes, Your Honor. And that is,
I assume your comments about the statements that were excluded are going to inform or not that theory, right?
That is correct, Your Honor. The duress defense, of course, requires that the offense committed first must have been of a lesser magnitude than the harm threatened. And secondly, the duress must have produced in the accused a reasonable fear of immediate or imminent death or serious bodily harm. Now, appellant is not asserting that the statements related to Lance Corporal Roberson by Donnie Mathis were what created that imminent apprehension in Lance Corporal Roberson. We feel that they must be considered in the context, though, of everything that led up to the moment when Dominic Madsen did show up and confront Lance Corporal Roberson and demand his money at that point. So it's not that statement, it's not what he felt necessarily at that point, which would qualify for meeting the apprehension required under duress, but we feel
it sounds a little vague. When did the first event happen in this case? They stole the checks when?
Yeah, I believe 1 December, sir.
Okay, and when did the last event
occur? 8 December, sir.
Okay, and between 1 and 8 December, did the appellant do anything like go to his first sergeant and say there's some person threatening me?
No, Your Honor, he did not. And I do not believe, though, actually, that it's based on our argument in this case, it's required that the duress was valid for the entire
week. I'm asking a flat question. I guess I want to hear your theory out further. What's happening between 1 and 8 December is indicative of duress?
Yes, Your Honor. We do not believe that
the concept of immediacy.
We do not believe he was under that duress for the entire week. And I think there are several plausible readings of how he might have been under duress when he actually forged the checks. He may have been under duress.
You're saying he was under duress, then he fell out of duress, and then the duress resumed?
That is a possible reading.
Well, I'm not interested in possibilities. I'm not sure who Judge Baker is, that I won't speak for him. But please elaborate your theory in response to Judge Baker's question.
Well, Your Honor, we think the evidentiary exclusions in this case and the effect they had on depriving the jury of their right to consider these matters, it could be applicable possibly just to one of the specifications, or it could be applicable to both of them if they felt that down the road, that is, sir, that the defense might apply just to one specification and not necessarily to both. However, it's also, I think, plausible that he felt like he was free and clear, or he felt additionally that perhaps he was under the threat from Dominic Madsen throughout the whole time.
based on the evidence.
How does that all equate to abuse of discretion? I mean, he could have. We've got to find abuse of discretion.
And I think it kind of relates more into that, the prejudice analysis, Your Honor. The abuse of discretion, I think, relates directly to the actual evidence that was excluded. And then I think it is informed by the context in which it was offered.
Counsel, I think that what we're trying to understand is to place the legal arguments within context is the charge sheet has one forgery taking place on December 11th. It has another forgery taking place on December 18th. At some time prior to either of those forgeries, the accused stole the checks that were later forged. We're trying to understand, or at least I would like to understand, when and how and where the alleged contacts or conversations that you are complaining about the military judge excluding took place.
Well, I think the date of those occurring is unclear from the record, Your Honor. However, it seems clear it was prior to these offense occurring. And I think it's what's so critical about it.
Why does it seem clear?
Well, I believe based on what I think it's just an inference drawn by what the substance of that statement, the statement that Dominic Madsen is out to get his money back from you based on the drugs that you threw out of his car, and he's going to come back and get that no matter what.
Let's talk about that statement. Would the appellant really want that statement regarding uncharged misconduct of throwing drugs out of a car? I mean, is that really a statement that you are arguing should have been admitted?
I think, Your Honor, it does. There certainly is a danger that could prejudice the members against him based on his association with this nefarious individual. At the same time, I think that evidence is what, and this is crucial, is what provides a credible account, a reasonable account, as to why Lance Corporal Roberson might actually be feeling the necessary apprehension. Sure, it doesn't necessarily paint him in the rosiest of pictures and who he associates with, but it does perhaps tell an account as to why it would be reasonable for him to actually feel that apprehension. Here is an individual, Dominic Madsen, who's clearly not a good guy, not a good dude, and he's coming to get him for this money. So
it says that your guy is not a good dude. It says that your guy threw drugs out of the window of a car. I mean, if that statement had been admitted, wouldn't you be up here arguing ineffective assistance of counsel?
Well, I don't believe so, Your Honor, because, again, they weren't necessarily his drugs. They were the drugs of Dominique Madsen, when the cops were behind him, he threw them out of his car. And again, I don't think it's, again, paints the best picture of Lance Corporal Roberson. At the same time, it presents a reasonable account as to why he might be feeling that apprehension. And because of that, and because of the defense's theory of the case, I believe it's why it's so important.
Now, the judge gave the duress instruction after all. What was that based on?
That was based on...
What's your catalog of indicators of duress then?
We have the testimony of the alleged victim in this case, who Lance Corporal Roberson came to talk to after the fact, and he explained to him why he took the checks and why he forged them. That was in evidence. You have the testimony of Lance Corporal Revell, who overheard a conversation outside of his barracks room between Lance Corporal Roberson and an unidentified individual, which tracked with the account the defense was attempting to put forward. And additionally, you have the stipulated testimony of the sister of Lance Corporal Roberson regarding a phone call that she received from an unknown individual threatening her brother's life if he told anyone about the checks.
The conversation by Lance Corporal, was it Revell? I'm sorry, what was his name?
Yes, Your Honor, Lance Corporal Revell.
I'm sorry, can I just ask one clarification? Do you have the dates of each of those things? We've thrown around a lot of dates up here. Do you have specific dates?
No, Your Honor, I was not able to identify a clear timeline for these.
The government argued with respect to Lance Corporal Revell in their closing argument, at least as I understood their closing argument, that conversation he claimed to have overheard took place after December 18th.
Again, Your Honor, I think it's the dates, at least from my reading, were a little unclear as to when everything played out. It seemed, were the testimony to be believed, that it would be prior to one of the checks being forged based on the substance of that testimony. So if testimony suggested was after the fact. I think the dates on the checks and the substance of the communication actually suggested it was prior to one of the checks being forged.
Counsel, do you agree that that's what the government argued in the case, that the one statement was made after the events?
Yes, Your Honor.
And did the government argue that any of the other statements transpired before or after the events? Did the government, in its objection to the admission of those statements, object on the grounds of the timeline?
I do not recall that being a basis for the objections, Your Honor. I believe the government, with respect to Ms. Krupa Lavelle, objected on the basis of hearsay, and the same thing with respect to the witness Donnie Mathis. And I think, turning briefly to the testimony.
Now, before we leave that, you began your argument by stating that the issue in this case is whether the appellant was subjected to duress. I don't see that in the granted issue. The granted issue I see is whether the military judge erred in excluding testimony. In this case, the military judge allowed the testimony of the duress to be introduced. The military judge allowed counsel to argue duress, and the military judge instructed on duress. So in that context, what was the duress and what was the evidence that demonstrated the duress from the defense perspective?
Absolutely.
That was excluded.
That was excluded, Your Honor?
Right. In other words, that's the granted issue in this case. That evidence was excluded. So what was the duress upon which the excluded evidence was going to be brought to bear?
And Your Honor, I think the best way to answer that question is to consider what the duress ended up looking like at trial, what was presented to the members, and compare that to what it would have looked like had the excluded testimony actually been admitted.
Well, if you can answer my question through that line, that's okay, but I'd like an answer to the question that I asked.
And I think if you look at what exactly was it Donnie Mathis could tell, and again, he was a witness with no demonstrated motive for bias. That sets him apart to a large degree from the self-serving statements of Lance Corporal Roberson, or what could be characterized as such. Though it's unclear, it appears that it would be statements related to him prior to these offenses actually occurring, which is also somewhat unique in that regard. And additionally, it fleshes out more the details of who this individual was.
Counsel, let's try again. I'll ask the questions one at a time. What was the testimony of duress that was introduced into this case, that was allowed to be introduced by the judge, that was argued by counsel, and that was instructed by the judge? What was the evidence of duress? Let's just start with that.
Well, you have the testimony of what Lance Corporal Roberson told to his roommate, to the alleged victim, or the victim in this case. You have the...
Well, no, Judge Efron is asking you to be more specific. Don't just say there was some testimony. What was the testimony?
He goes to his roommate and he says, I'm sorry, this guy, Donnie Madsen, came, pointed a gun at me and made me write out the checks, take the checks, and fill them out. Lance Corporal Lavelle testified about this conversation he overheard outside of his room, which essentially was an individual, an unknown individual, speaking in unfriendly terms or unfriendly tone, addressing him that you're going to deposit those checks and then I'm going to get the money from you.
Okay, so evidence was admitted that a third party pointed the gun at the head of the defendant, or pointed the gun at the defendant, and compelled him to write checks. Is that what the evidence is of duress?
An unknown individual. Yes, sir.
An unknown individual. Okay. Then what evidence was excluded, which in the defense view bears on that testimony?
I think, Your Honor, you there obviously you have a large portion of the defense presented, but as far as presenting what something that could be credible, that's where the importance of Donnie Mathis's testimony comes in. He can identify the individual by name and say that he is the type of guy that would be aggressive enough to do this. He not only that, he actually told him that he's going to go and get his money no matter what, and he gave the rationale for why Donnie Mathis would be acting that way. And though the defense did get to present part of the defense, the part that was excluded is, in our opinion, what can make this account credible in front of the members.
Specifically, what part was that?
The identification of Dominic Mattson, the rationale for why he was attempting to get his money back from Lance Corporal Roberson, and the fact that he had a handgun.
Didn't the victim testify that that's also what he was told?
Yes, Your Honor. However, those were statements that were related to him by Lance Corporal Roberson. Unlike Donnie Mathis, who is an individual who knows both of them, who has no dog in this fight, and could actually fill the members in on that as well.
What's your argument under 8033 as to why that evidence should come in?
Well, Your Honor, I think it goes to show that the intent of the declarant, in this case Dominic Mathis, was subsequently carried out. And if you compare the military judge's analysis of that testimony that he excluded with that of Lance Corporal Revelle that he actually admitted, under the same basis, I think it illustrates just how he abused his discretion and applied an inconsistent legal standard.
You were arguing, I'm so fussing about duress, you were arguing that the duress occurred prior to the events in question. I heard you answer that. That was your response to Judge Ryan.
Well, the duress had to be, I think, when he was writing the checks, he had to feel that apprehension. I think that the testimony of Donnie Mathis is crucial.
Is there any testimony that the duress continued past the first event? Is there any evidence of that at all?
Not on the record as it
well,
stands.
Well, is there any in what the judge excluded?
Your Honor, I think, though it's not clear that it did, it's not unreasonable to infer that it could have. And that's a decision.
Is that an abuse of discretion?
That, again, I would argue would relate more towards the prejudice, Your Honor, as far as whose role it is to decide what weight to accord that evidence.
Of the items that were excluded, from your perspective, which one provides the strongest corroboration of the statement that was made by the witness, which was admitted, showing that this defendant was under duress at the time he wrote the checks? Which is the strongest of all? We talked about a lot of statements and a lot of inferences. Is there one in there that you would say provides the clearest corroboration of the statement that was admitted?
I would argue, sir, that the strongest would be the testimony of Donnie Mathis about why Dominic Mathis was after Lance Corporal Roberson for the money.
Could you give us the record site and identify that, because there are many different statements that were made here.
Yes, Your Honor, I could probably give you the exact quote better on my rebuttal, just to make sure I have it all correct, but it is, he states, Dominic told me that he's coming to get his money, is your money for throwing his drugs out the window, and he's coming to get it no matter what. I can get the exact site for that on rebuttal, sir.
Let's start with page 827.
So, isn't a lot of this cumulative? I mean, leave aside throwing the drugs out of the window, which is egregious uncharged misconduct, as Judge Ryan pointed out. Did your client really want that to come in? But leave that aside. Isn't most of the rest of this cumulative? It went in that he had a gun. It may not have gone that he had a .45, but come on now. It went in that he threatened him. I mean, isn't this cumulative and basically repetitious?
I don't believe it is cumulative, Your Honor, for several reasons. One, again, and as I mentioned earlier, this witness kind of stands apart in the fact that there was no demonstrated motive for bias on his account.
Well, that doesn't go to whether it's cumulative or not.
It goes to the uniqueness of the evidence, Your Honor.
You mean he's the only guy you had that any reasonable fact finder would believe?
That's not exactly how I would phrase it, sir. I would state that he is just a voice that the members could hear that comes from, that offers a different perspective, and a perspective that is unique from all the other individuals. Additionally, he fleshes out the detail, which no one else does, and that we think is pretty critical as well as far as assessing the reasonableness of the duress defense in this case.
I wanted to ask you, are you open for business on the ADP issue?
Pardon, Your Honor?
Are you available for appellate delay? We're not doing that?
No.
Okay. Disregard?
Yes, Your Honor. Turning to the analysis of prejudice at this point, appellant believes that the error was neither harmless nor harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
Which should apply here? Which standard are you applying?
Your Honor, we would argue the correct standard would be to test for harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. That is, that it would rise to constitutional dimensions.
Why?
Sure. I think there are two reasons, and really kind of two sides of the same coin. Primarily, the effect of the exclusion would argue deprived Ernest Cripple Roberson of the right to present evidence that was material, that was relevant and vital to his defense, and that went to the heart of his defense. And additionally, the military judge, as a result of his exclusions, deprived the members of the right to decide those facts and to decide what proper weight to accord to those facts.
Counsel, if that were the case, every evidentiary error would be a constitutional violation. In context of Judge Stuckey's questions as to whether this was cumulative or not, you responded that some of the evidence provided perspective from a different person. But none of that testimony, as far as I can see, that was excluded, deprived the appellant of the opportunity to assert his defense. It may have affected the effectiveness, it may have been prejudicial under a harmless standard, but could you identify where he was denied the opportunity to raise the defense of duress in this case?
I would say he was deprived of the opportunity to present a complete defense, Your Honor. And when I define complete, I would...
What was incomplete about the instructions that the judge gave in this case?
Well, the instructions, Your Honor, were complete. The evidence available by the defense could place in front of the members as far as proving up that defense is what was problematic.
Then I'll go back to my original question. If that's the standard, why isn't every improper exclusion of evidence a constitutional error? Because every time evidence is excluded, it deprives the fact finder of the opportunity to consider it.
Well, Your Honor, I would say it's just a question of degree, and it's just
what
a matter
case
of
stands for that proposition.
Pardon, Your Honor?
What case stands for the proposition that in considering the exclusion of evidence that there's a question of degree involved here when the defense is otherwise completely presented?
Well, I don't have a case specifically with the same procedural posture, and I acknowledge that. However, following the logic of the lower court in both Barnes and Tulin, and additionally, if comparing it to other issues that do rise to constitutional dimensions, such as was present in McAllister and Traveler, I think this is merely a matter of applying the facts of a particular case to a legal standard, and here whether what the evidence that was excluded went to the heart of a defendant's case and was so material and vital to it that the exclusion of it did rise to those constitutional dimensions. And again, the contrast with Toohey, the second Toohey, a relatively recent case where this court considered or entertained the idea of whether the exclusion of character for peacefulness rose to a constitutional dimension. In that case, this Court rejected that that rose to a constitutional dimension, stating that that did not go to the heart of the defense case. And so I think this is a standard that gets applied somewhat frequently by this Court and other courts. I have not found it exactly in this type of procedural posture. So it's different from Barnes and Tulin, and that was a case where the Court prevented the defense from putting on any evidence of the defense. However, I think logically, if even though the members were instructed regarding a particular defense, that even though that was done, that a military judge, through his exclusions, could so eviscerate the defense case that the effect, the concerns, the policy concerns, would still be present and would be the same.
Your time has expired. Unless my colleagues have further questions at this point, you'll have an opportunity on rebuttal.
Thank you, sir.
We will now hear, we have two amici today, and we'll hear for counsel for amicus, who is presenting on behalf of appellant.
Chief Judge, may I proceed? Good afternoon, and may it please the Court. My name is Jonathan William, and seated behind me are my co-counsel and the brief writers, Matthew Sein and Jonathan Shaver. We support, as amicus, the appellant Marine Corps Lance Corporal Isaac D. Roberson. We strongly support Lance Corporal Roberson for two reasons. First, the denial of evidence to be heard by the fact finders during the special court-martial was an abuse of discretion. And second, the exclusion of this evidence was materially prejudicial under the Kerr test, which was cited from Weeks, because it destroyed the affirmative defense address by removing key facts and timelines that the fact finders would have applied along with the duress instruction from the judge, and it would have made a more complete and logical defense for the fact finders to decide upon.
Well, could you present for us in summary form what the defense argument would have been in closing if this information had been admitted?
Yes, sir. I believe that under the United States v. Barnes case, although it is distinguishable, I believe it would have made a more complete and logical case if the fact finders...
Can you be more specific then about complete?
I believe
the appellant's counsel pointed to granularity in terms of Matson's motive. The appellant's counsel pointed to the fact that the testimony might have ID'd Matson as the caller, and spoke about having a witness who could address the topic who wasn't directly related or, in fact, the appellant.
Yes, sir.
Is that a fair list? Would you supplement that list?
I believe the fact...
Dissect complete.
Yes, sir. I believe the fact that the appellant in this case was on notice of the Mr. Matson, Dominic Matson in this case, I believe that he was on notice that he was going to come out to get him, started the arrest, and it began and it concluded after he had forged the checks. Did I answer your question?
Not exactly. The delta? Do you know delta? What's the difference between the victim saying, this is what the appellant told me, Matson was making him do this, he has a gun, and what the excluded testimony would have provided in addition?
I believe what the victim heard was from the appellant himself, and what Mr. Mathis heard was from Mr. Matson, Dominic Matson. So I think it's really two different. They're both disinterested, but one comes directly from the source, which is the appellant, and one comes from a disinterested third party that heard it from Mr. Matson himself. And I think that's a distinction there.
What is your theory as to the duration of the duress to be? In other words, assuming arguendo, he was placed under duress prior to the first offense in time. A substantial amount of time elapsed between that and the second offense. Is it your theory that that he was still in imminent fear, which is what the defense requires? at the time he uttered the checks, the time he forged the checks, which was 8 days later?
Yes, sir. I believe the duress began when... I'm sure he always had an imminent fear of Mr. Mattson, just based on the circumstances.
Well, what evidence is there? I mean, did Mattson renew it? Is there any evidence that Mattson... Is there any evidence in the excluded material, the proffered material, that Mattson renewed any sort of threat in the interim?
No, sir, they're not. There is not renewed evidence, however.
Well, then didn't he have plenty of time to go to the police, the CID, the authorities, his bank, his mother, his priest, or someone, and try and get out of this?
Really, the important distinction to make is that the members should have heard the testimony to decide for themselves. It's really a question of fact that the members should have heard that would make a more complete defense of duress, because Lance Corporal Roberson just looked like a Marine with a story full of holes without this testimony that kind of linked the timing together.
Counsel?
Yes, ma'am.
Doesn't it strengthen your argument that in closing argument, the trial counsel basically dismissed the statement that Roberson made to his roommate as lacking in credibility?
No, ma'am. I mean, he is not disinterested. He has an interest in the statement. However,
what I'm saying is the fact that the trial counsel took that statement and basically said what you're saying here today, which is he knew he was caught and he's just trying to come up with some reason to explain the inexplicable, and so he's making up this story. And in the absence of the testimony that you all wanted to have admitted, that there was nothing to corroborate what he had told his roommate.
Yes, ma'am. Really, our position is that the fact finder should have heard all the testimony that was not hearsay and relevant and let them decide. And although...
Well, wasn't much of this hearsay?
I believe the statements are not hearsay. The statement in question was not offered to prove the truth of the matter asserted, and it was a court statement, but it was not offered to prove the truth of the matter asserted. It was offered.
Well, you can argue that only so far. I mean, you're saying it was only offered to show that it was said and that he was put in fear.
Yes, sir.
But without basically taking it for the truth of the matter asserted, that he had some rational fear, where does that leave you?
Leaves you with testimony that if the members would have heard, they may have inferred that he was under duress. Although, it does leave you, if it can be considered hearsay, it still falls under the 803 exception, a state of mind.
Which of the five statements in question do you think you're the strongest legal argument on in terms of the judge erring, just out of interest?
We submit that the strongest argument was the statement made from Dominic Mattson to Mr. Mathis, because it should have been offered to show that a conversation took place, and just the fact that took place, the value...
Yeah, I'm not talking about the value of it. I'm talking about if we're just doing pure law, which is the most... the strongest error in terms of your argument about the military judge's ruling. If you had to pick one and say, this is what I'm going to show was legal error, not effect, but legal error, which is the strongest?
I'm going to get my money no matter nothing, I think, is the statement that makes the most, because it shows to us, it shows no matter nothing, I'm going to get my money. Under the exclusion of the testimony was materially prejudicial to Lance Corporal Roberson, because it undercut his ability to present a logical defense. Now, we cite the Kerr test, which cited Weeks, and there are four factors which you can take into consideration to decide whether it was material or prejudicial. The first factor is the strength of the government's case.
One more question. I'll ask you the same question I asked the previous counsel. Isn't the great bulk of this cumulative?
Yes, sir, it is cumulative.
Well, then why should the judge have let it in?
Because that's for the fact finders to decide what's important and what's not, because they were there to hear the testimony.
Well, under that rule, anything goes in, because it's always for the fact finders to decide. And what? Why do you need a military judge? if you just let in cumulative testimony just because it would be nice for the fact finders to hear it. I mean, what's your standard?
The standard is that it was not hearsay. It should have
been. Well, I didn't ask whether it was hearsay. I asked whether it was cumulative.
Yes, sir. It did go to the same effect of showing duress. However, it showed a disinterested third party, the statement from Matson and Mathis. Did I answer your question, sir?
Yeah.
Under the Kirk test of strength of government's case, while the government presented a strong case in chief, this court has ruled in U.S. v. Vasquez that the government bears the burden to disprove the duress defense and beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, withholding the facts supporting the appellant's duress defense greatly lessened the burden for the government. Now, when this burden was lessened, they didn't have the duty to rebut it as strongly as they would have had. The strength of the defense case, the disinterested testimony of Mr. Mathis would have strengthened the duress defense because it put holes in the story that made the members, I'm sure, think the story is not believable. We're not seeing a link. It's not linking up. The timing is, we don't understand the timing, so I'm sure allowing that testimony would have given them a more complete picture. I can't put a percentage on, I see my time is...
You can complete your thought, and we'll have the benefit of your brief for the balance of your argument.
Thank you, sir. We believe that the excluded testimony was very material, and excluding this showed duress was as an incomplete story, and Lance Corporal Roberson deserves due process and right to a fair trial. He doesn't deserve a perfect trial, but a fair trial at the least. And as amicus, we submit that it's very important that this court legally follow the rules that have been set forth and find the appellant and reverse the court below and send it back. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your argument.
Thank you.
We'll now hear from counsel for the government.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. Lieutenant Mark Harrington for the United States. Appellant claimed the affirmative defense of duress in his trial for larceny and forgery. His theory was that a Mr. Matson had placed a gun to his head and forced him to steal his roommate's checks, forge them, and deposit them into his account. The military judge properly instructed the members regarding this defense, and they rejected it. They rejected it because appellant was unable to explain away the glaring inconsistencies in his theory. He was unable to explain why, if he was in fear for his life, he would write Happy Holidays and Merry Xmas on the two checks that he forged. He was unable to explain why, if he stole the checks on December 1st or 2nd, and then wrote the checks on December 11th and 18th, respectively, he was at no point able to notify authorities of this alleged assault.
Don't those points go to the second part of the analysis, which was he prejudiced if the military judge erred?
They certainly do. I'm simply trying to show a context for the judge at this, or for the case at this point. And ultimately, that is the question on whether or not it was harmless. But as to the first issue of whether or not the military judge abused his discretion, the government's position is that he did not, and that even if this court were to find that he abused his discretion, any such error was harmless.
Is your argument on the duress, you don't take issue that if a drug dealer were coming after you to collect money, you would agree in concept that one might feel duress? Is that a fair assumption?
There's a theoretical possibility that a duress defense.
Putting aside whether you accept that that's the case here, a drug dealer stipulating that there's a drug dealer who thinks you owe him money and he's coming after you, that could, in theory, create duress?
Yes, Your Honor.
Could that, in theory, create continuing duress?
The idea of continuing duress is an interesting one, and it could theoretically happen under RCM 9, 16H, the theory of defense. Theory of duress, it speaks of immediacy and what that really means, and it's a case-by-case factual scenario that has to be determined on whether or not there's immediacy and whether they have a reasonable opportunity to avoid committing the crime in order to avoid the threat. There's just simply not enough evidence in this case of any sort of reason for why he wasn't able to go to authorities. And another...
Just to be clear, you don't necessarily take issue with the conceptual theory the appellant's putting forth, you're arguing that the facts don't fit it.
Yes, Your Honor.
I just want to, is that a fair statement?
Yes, Your Honor. There's certainly
that the judge erred and he shouldn't have given the duress instruction.
Your Honor?
Sounds like your view is that the judge erred and he shouldn't have given the duress instruction.
Certainly, Your Honor, the military judge did not err. Perhaps there's a bit of an abundance of caution, but based on the testimony from the appellant's roommate, that when appellant had apologized to him for stealing the checks, that he said, I did it only because this Mr. Madsen held a gun to my head and made me do it. That was brought in under the rule of completeness, but it was allowed to be argued for the truth of the matter asserted. And with that evidence before the members of the court-martial, certainly that is enough evidence that the military judge was proper in instructing.
Probably required to instruct on that.
Most likely, yes, Your Honor.
Then why was the later comment that Madsen owned a gun, why was that not relevant?
That is the weakest argument for the government, Your Honor, trying to jump to a question you would typically ask. That is the hardest one to decide whether or not that evidence was enough to let the military judge decide that it was relevant, the fact that he had owned a gun. The military judge, during the time of discussing that with counsel, mentioned the fact that he, too, has access to a 9mm, as does trial counsel.
Does the government think that the military judge erred there?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe the military judge abused his discretion because even if I personally or this court would have decided differently that perhaps it was relevant, that's not the only issue on whether or not you may have decided differently, but rather whether the military judge abused his discretion as a gatekeeper under MRE 402 as to what he considers to be relevant. He believes that the self-serving...
Well, how did he not abuse his discretion if he's going to give a duress instruction? There's evidence, and the instruction in theory, apparently, according to you, is based on the fact that at least the victim said that he held a gun to his head. Why is it not an abuse of discretion?
What's
the theory that it's not relevant? Just everybody owns guns?
Absolutely. That is the theory, that having the...
But isn't the critical issue whether Madsen owns a gun?
It is only in the case that Madsen using that gun. It's the basic idea of theater, that in the first act, you should not introduce a gun unless you're going to actually use that gun in the second act. In this case, they were trying to introduce the first act, that Madsen saying that he had a gun, without direct testimony and compelling, credible evidence that he ever used a gun in the second act. The only statement made regarding the second act is the self-serving hearsay statement from appellant to his roommate claiming that. The military judge found that not to be sufficient evidence to make it any more reliable or important that Madsen owned a gun than saying that Charles
found it sufficient to give the duress instruction, but not sufficient.
Yes, Your Honor.
That's your argument.
It was sufficient to give the duress instruction because it could be argued for the truth of the matter asserted, but still, as the gatekeeper, the military judge did not find it to be credible enough to raise it here, as he put it during that discussion, also with the 8033 evidence and those hearsay statements.
I mean, counsel, the trial counsel argued on the motion with respect to the statement about the gun, at page 836 of the record, that it's because whether or not Dominique Madsen owns a gun is not relevant at this point. There has been no testimony and there have been no facts in front of the members that Dominique Madsen pointed a gun at the accused. Is that the test as to whether evidence that Madsen had a gun is relevant?
It is in this case when the idea of whether or not Mr. Madsen owning a gun is relevant, there has to be some testimony, some credible evidence, according to the military judge, that gun was actually used in some way that has a bearing on the trial. Otherwise, saying that the military judge has access to a weapon, or Charlton Heston owns many guns, is completely irrelevant to the members.
But wouldn't it be a fair inference for the members to make, a fair inference for them to make, from the fact that Madsen had a gun, when the accused told his roommate that someone pointed a gun to his head, that he was telling the truth?
It is. It is certainly a possibility. And again, there is a strong argument that can be made that it was relevant.